Mike, and the Hot.
And we're back. Welcome once again to another episode of Mike, and Oscar. I'm your co-host, Mike One. Co-host also, Mike is here. An Oscar race checkpoint for your ear holes today, covering a lot of different facets of the movie industry. We got trailers, we got news, and we got business news that neither one of us are really qualified to speak about, Michael.
But we shall speak about all of it with this tone of voice.
Yeah
we have the Paramount deal that was with Skydance, and still may be, but apparently they kind of closed their exclusive negotiating window because they could not come up with a deal. Sony Apollo has got their offer back on the table. First I'm learning that Sony's with Apollo, apparently. Warren Buffett sold his Paramount stock. We got Sony and who else? Skydance kind of at the deal making table.
Yeah.
So with Paramount. So what the hell's going on here, Mike?
We've talked about this before, and then last week it seemed like there was a deal that was close to being made with Skydance and Paramount, and like Mike said, the exclusivity window for those negotiations fell by the wayside, and so now all the trades are saying, well, that deal seems like it's not going to be made, because why would Skydance like open up negotiations if Paramount's going to be free to negotiate with other people? Which I
Would these companies why would they ever leak to the press that the deal is not exactly what they want? Like, I've never heard that before, ever. Like, posturing through the press?
Yeah, that's a newfangled thing. Might create some leverage, but okay. So, what are the difference right now between the Skydance Ellison family offer and the Apollo Sony offer? The Ellison Skydance offer is the one which would net Sherry Redstone, who, like we said, is the big decision maker here. She runs Paramount currently through her holdings with National Amusement. She's the biggest vote. She owns like 77% of the voting shares of Paramount stock right now. So she alone can make this decision. But the Skydance / Ellison family offer that was on the table for Paramount would net Sherry Redstone personally around $2 billion. But it would leave the deal open to current shareholders to turn around and potentially file a class action lawsuit or possibly seek an injunction against the merger, claiming that the varying valuations and the different kinds of stock as detailed in the deal would not be equitable and only favor a few at the expense of many.
I can't get over that $2 billion number. I'm fixated at that on that for what you were talking about. So what are these meetings doing? It's just like, Sherry, I think we should go with Sony. Skydance worries me a little bit. I think they're going to make Tom Cruise animated. And I don't think Tom Cruise wants to be animated. And Sherry's like, look, I agree to disagree. I want to go with Skydance.
We have to go to Skydance. Why? No reason. Yeah.
No reason.
The Sony Apollo offer is said to be $26 billion all cash. It would be paying a premium for all class of outstanding Paramount stock. So this is something that's likely to eschew any kind of lawsuit from shareholders. And shareholders are obviously more in favor of this, as the premium, I think, being paid per share of stock for all class of stock. In this case, I think it was like 26% above what it is right now or something like that. But obviously the other side of that is that the theory, at least, is that as far as personal wealth for Sherry Redstone personally, she wouldn't have her own $2 billion payout at the end of that rainbow, even though she actually might, which I'll get into in a second. But nonetheless, it wouldn't go directly into her pocket. So there's some theorizing that that's why she's dragging her feet there. I think it's a little more intense and complicated than that. So let's talk about Sherry Redstone personally. The problem, it's like I said, she has all the power in terms of voting to ratify any deal with Paramount. She, via her family holdings of National Amusements, again, an entity which she herself is president of currently, own 77% of the voting shares of Paramount stock. So the best guess through the punditry this past weekend was that she really wants the Ellison Skydance deal, obviously, but could be getting worried that about the very real possibility of a potential suit could end up having merit and could succeed against her, thus probably costing her even more out of pocket in the short and possibly long term. But rather than just turn around and accept the Sony deal instead, which would placate the rest of the shareholders, she may wait it out and let Paramount run as the fledgling enterprise it has been for the past couple years, only now, without a singular person or figurehead being responsible for all of it in the public eye, like Bob Bakish was. The former CEO, obviously, was relieved of his duties last week. We talked about that in our last episode.
So, while you're reading all that and that beautiful stuff that you wrote, I'm basically jostling back before the middle or the end of Succession Season 2. I think it's the middle, and Sherry's actually like the faux New York Times group.
Okay.
And I don't know if there's a, you know, I don't know if there's a family of delinquents involved at any part of this, but I hope they are. In my mind's eye, they are there. You like my contribution?
I wonder if this is like Succession without the kids. It's just Brian Cox.
that's what I'm wondering.
There's no torment. There's no like family infighting whatsoever. It's just four seasons of him waiting to make a decision.
Well, Ellison, I guess Ellison has the famous daughter, right?
Yep.
That's his. Yeah. So this could be. I don't know him at all. I would like him to be Brian Cox.
He's welcome at our dinner table anytime if he wants friends. Yeah.
Brian Cox-esque. He would make a great narrator for McDonald's commercials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He can join James Bond products that he thinks are actually the next movie, but they aren't. And they're just reality shows based on the IP. Sure.
And he could shoot from the hip every time he talks to the media. He doesn't give any Fs, by the way, Brian Cox.
He's great. He's great.
Please proceed.
Joaquin Phoenix sucked in Napoleon. That was basically a quote from him last week. Anyway, okay, let's talk about the specifics of the Apollo-Sony deal. Not much is known about them. End of the specifics there. No. So what the Apollo-Sony deal reportedly would look like outside of the $14 billion of that 26, which would be earmarked for current Paramount debt, is really unknown. William Cohen, writing for Puck, did a breakdown of what he theorized the Class A and Class B stocks would get as payouts. And if he's correct, what he made the case was that really there would be about $2 billion waiting for Sherry Redstone should the Sony Apollo deal be the one that Paramount takes. So she probably wouldn't end up losing all that much money in the long run, picking either of the two sides of this. If these are the only two options available to her anyway, whichever one she goes with, she probably wouldn't lose much personally financially, which has to indicate that there are other things going on as to why she's dragging her feet. And one of those other things may be is that the Sony Apollo deal would not relieve her of National Amusements, whereas the Skydance deal would have. National Amusements would not be part of any deal made with Sony and Apollo. So Sherry Redstone and the Redstone family would keep National Amusements and those theater chains. Skydance would have absorbed those. On top of that, if there is some kind of difference in personal wealth between the two deals, those two things combined may make her drag her feet. And there is a third intangible in this, whereas Sony and Apollo, it seems like, want to chop up Paramount's goods, which a lot of the hand-wringing comes over the cable stations that are under the Paramount umbrella, which are still making money, but obviously are not the assets they would have been in the late 90s, early 2000s, with cord cutting and streaming being prevalent nowadays, and et cetera, et cetera. The word is that Sony would want to chop all those up and maybe kind of like parse out the different Paramount IPs and the different Paramount assets. And Sherry Redstone has been resistant to that idea. So all of those three reasons combined are kind of why it seems like she's kind of reticent to accept the Sony Apollo offer as it is.
I wonder if Skydance would want to basically take Paramount and turn it into one of the foremost competitors for Sony, because Paramount probably backs away from the streaming and from the Paramount Plus streamer apparatus, do you think? Or do you think that they are trying to become profitable? Because we've seen a lot of rumors out there that Paramount wants to merge with another streamer or whatever. But basically, if you have a deal that clears all your debt, wouldn't it make sense to then, all right, now we're going to just be the studio. We're going to provide content for all of these or for these other streamers and for theaters. And, you know, and that's what Sony's doing.
Well, the studio certainly seems like it's the most attractive asset in this portfolio, without question.
Yeah. But is it because of the IP necessarily, or is it just because they know how to get stuff done? They know how to make good movies.
It's probably a combination. I mean, look, a bad Mission Impossible movie still probably makes hundreds of millions of dollars in profit, right? You know what I mean? So
well,
except for this last one, yeah. But it's probably because of the latter, probably because of the IP that's tied it, and that's still a potential outcome of this deal. Like, I was listening to Bellany on a different podcast. I can't remember the name of it. It wasn't Puck related. I think it was like something like News Today or something like that that he did. And he basically said there's like three outcomes left. One is maybe Sherry Redstone takes one of these deals or a new deal in which Paramount is fully divested from her holdings. Two would be she lets Paramount run as is with that triumvirate of new CEO office holders, as opposed to Bob Backus. We talked about the three people she tabbed to lead Paramount currently right now. But the problem with that, obviously, is the more time that goes by with Paramount in the status quo, the less money Paramount's going to be worth. I mean, they're just... They're hemorrhaging cash at this point, and they're hemorrhaging value to any kind of shareholder or equity holder. So, I don't know that that's really a viable option. Or three could be some offer comes along just to divest her of the studio, or maybe buy her out of her placement within these holdings personally. So maybe somebody comes along and just buys Sherry Redstone's placement as opposed to buying the studio and all the assets. Maybe they buy her out of her options and maybe they become the majority shareholder and the majority voting shareholder of Paramount. And they become the decision maker as to what to do with this next. So those are kind of the three options that Bellany was theorizing could happen. I did like, though, in reading the Puck article, William Cohen wrote, he did, like any good, you know, Hollywood blockbuster, he left a post-credit scene at the end here, which made me feel really good about how I've seen this Paramount thing go down personally, because he said that he teased the idea that if Paramount embraces the status quo and they do start losing more value, they obviously become more available or more, it's more likely more suitors get involved in the bidding process for them. And he's wondering if they lose value to the point where it's enough for David Zasloff to jump in. And we've talked numerous times on this show about how WB, all they want to do is fatten up their library to inevitably sell themselves off to somebody in Silicon Valley. So if they came along and they purchased the Paramount studio especially, that would be a huge impact to their library and make them far more valuable in the long term to do such a thing like selling themselves off.
Fascinating. So, and do you think that last one is really possible?
I've theorized about the... I mean, it's just like a simple math equation in my head. So obviously I haven't gotten like too into the weeds of what is possible or what's like mathematically viable for the balance sheet of WB or anything like that. But like, we know Zaslav's intentions are to cut costs and increase value. Now, obviously, if you're going to buy something like Paramount, that's going to be a huge outlay of cost. But the value that the Paramount library would bring in, if you're incorporating that into, now you have all those shows and movies and IPs that you can fold into Max as well, that's going to make Max profitable. Add to that what the actual goal of streaming is for all these companies, which is just to get like user and buyer information to sell that off to other companies and make that, you know, have that data available to them. Eventually, Max, if they brought in another major studio, I think that's going to be a huge coup for them to make themselves more valuable.
How does the government allow this? Because that seems to me...
Well, that's the million-dollar question, yeah.
Target selling to Walmart, selling to Amazon.
Yep.
Right? I mean, how does
that... Sure sounds like a monopoly, doesn't it?
How do they allow that?
Yeah. So that's, I mean, and that was another facet that was brought up in all the articles I read, is that like there could be an impetus to wait until the end of the year here, November, December, until we know who the next 4 years of the White House are going to be. Because obviously the Biden administration, if there is one, would be much more scrutinized or have a much more watchful eye over any kind of potential giant merger like that, theorizing, than any Trump administration would be. So there could be that could be playing a role in this as well. I mean, we're talking about $1 billion, billions upon billions of dollars enterprise here, so there are a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, we're talking about a $2 billion parachute.
Yeah.
Golden parachute.
Right, for one person, so.
Oh, my God.
Paramount, as it stands today, well, we're recording this on the 8th of May, it's business as usual, no deal yet.
And I'm sure the deal will happen by the time this episode's released.
Let's talk about, and we'll pivot to some festival news now. Meryl Streep is going to be honored with an honorary Palme d'Or at Cannes, though she won't be getting the Palme d'Or, I hear, or will she?
No, unless she really goes into character. But no, this is cool. This is Meryl Streep, George Lucas, and now Hayao Miyazaki as the major honorees at the Cannes Film Festival this year. Studio Ghibli is going to be the honoree, technically speaking, there. But an elite group of legends here, sure. And this is smart by the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah, I saw the Lucas story a couple weeks ago. Wouldn't it be weird if Meryl Streep took the award and she was like, I was the dog in Anatomy of a Fall?
This whole time.
Just a standing ovation. Oh, she can do anything.
She can.
The Most Precious of Cargoes, an animated film, has been added to the Cannes lineup as well.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about The Most Precious of Cargoes because this comes from the director of The Artist, Michael Hajavizhan.
That's right. I think that's the pronunciation, yeah.
And Michael Hajavizhan, obviously he's an Oscar-winning director there. Look, international animated films have been getting nominated, have been contending, have been winning Oscars of late. The Boy and the Heron, the most recent last year. Robot Dreams was also nominated there. So we were wondering about that category where we kind of do two down the middle with our predictions, and now The Most Precious of Cargoes, big name director, animated film, big spot here at the Cannes Film Festival. Just something to look out for.
Hazanicious?
Okay.
Hazanicious.
We weren't doing a podcast back when The Artist won Best Picture, so I don't know.
That's exactly why we don't know it. Yeah. Luca Guadagnino's next film, it's going to be, we talked about this, an adaptation of William S. Burroughs' Queer, starring Daniel Craig and Drew Starkey. It's expected to hit the festival circuit in late 2024.
So smart picks by you from our last episode. This means that Queer will be vying for Oscars this year. That's for certain, it would seem, because a big-name director taking it to fall film festivals, that usually doesn't stay on the shelf. So who's going to acquire the film Queer? Luca has worked with Amazon MGM on Challengers, Bones and All, and Suspiria. Will Amazon MGM step up again here? Call Me By Your Name was acquired, though, by Sony Pictures Classics the last time he had an acquisition property available, and they acquired that at Sundance for $6 million. So would Sony reteam with Luca here? I don't know. I think this is going to be a fascinating subplot to the season. What do people think of this property as the festivals happen? So that's, again, these are just subplots of the festivals that I just think are fascinating to follow from afar.
That's something we hammered often in the 100% accurate way too early Oscar predictions episode we did, was that there's so many potential Oscar players out there who are still looking for homes for distributors. From distributors, I should say, and that certainly is chief among them. Isabelle Huppert has been named the jury president of Cannes, Michael.
Oh, I'm sorry, of Venice. Venice.
I see. I Greta saw Gerwig. Golden Lion too, and I was like, I don't think that's Cannes, but I always confuse Cannes and Venice, and I'm just never going to get them straight. So it's of Venice. I'm sorry. That's my fault.
One's in the water, and one's on the beach.
That doesn't help at all.
No, because Venice is literally in the water.
Yeah, I know.
It's like Atlantis.
But then I'm like, well, if there's water near, there's got to be a beach nearby.
Bunch of us Italians. But no, there's no beach.
I understand. I'm a dumb American is my point.
All right. So look, I wrote down all of the jury presidents, the Golden Lion winners, and the films that eventually got nominated for Oscars. And basically to show you what won over the other films. Now, does Isabelle Huppert tell you anything? I mean, she's from Elle, she's from all the French movies that you don't watch, Mike, but she's been in a few English language films, and she's always good. Does her being the jury president, and does the recent track record of jury presidents tell you anything about this pick? Does this give you an inkling of what she might choose, what her taste is?
I'm trying hard to come up with one on the spot, reading the list of previous presidents and the films that won. But
Guillermo del Toro picked his buddy's film. That was like, that's
yeah,
the
but
only
it was worthy too.
Here.
It was worthy,
right?
I mean, Roma. It's not like Roma was a bona fide Oscar contender.
I was surprised, like one of the bros didn't pick Joker, bro. That was a female filmmaker, from an Italian female filmmaker, yeah. Lucrezia Martel.
Yeah,
bro. Joker won with her, bro. She loved it, bro. We're gonna like Joker Folie à Deux, aren't we?
It's
aren't we? And the bros are gonna hate it, and we're the bros are gonna hate us.
And we'll be singing during our review of it, singing only songs from West Side Story. I
don't know. I don't know if this list tells me anything.
Yeah,
I
mean, because it seems like they get it right, though, at Venice, historically.
Well, look at this. Yeah, look at this. Now, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, that was a high grade for me. It did win over Tar, Banshees, and the Whale.
Right.
Tar and Banshees, that's a tough pick. Happening, that's an inspired pick over Power of the Dog.
But you can absolutely see Power of the Dog not playing well, even though it did win Best Director that year, obviously. I mean, it's a slower movie. Nomadland won Best Picture, even though we probably favorite pieces of a woman anyway, but that was the COVID year.
Yeah. Roma over The Favorite. Okay.
Yeah.
Shape of Water over Three Billboards. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah, they may not get the eventual Oscar winner, Best Picture winner, right? But they're like, they're in the conversation there. They end up picking one that's going to be, you know, and then it's the chicken and the egg conversation. What happened first? Does Venice shape the Oscars, or are these movies good enough to play well at both regardless? So,
but even the indie darling jury presidents like Julianne Moore or Lucrezia Martel, or, you know, they pick big name films. You don't know what the hell they're going to pick.
Right.
Or, you know, I don't know. Maybe Julianne Moore kind of picked but that was a... I thought Sony was All the Beauty. No, Neon, excuse me. Okay. So maybe if Path has or Studio Canal has their biggest film in years premiering at the festival, maybe Isabelle Huppert might influence that.
Maybe Huppert is just a huge Lars von Trier fan, and that's who she... That'd be something.
Maybe she loves Michael Hazevich.
Audrey Dewan's Emmanuel, a big one for also Mike's 100% way too early Oscars predictions here, will open the San Sebastian Film Festival, and that's where we'll have its world premiere.
All right, pros and cons. Pros about San Sebastian. Last year, The Boy and the Heron opened the San Sebastian Film Festival, had no issues going on to Oscar success.
Right.
So The Boy and the Heron had a weird kind of layout, though, into its campaign, because it opened in Japan off of just a poster and no marketing whatsoever. A cryptic poster,
Miyazaki didn't, he specifically requested there be no marketing.
Correct. So then it played at TIFF and New York Film Festival, or TIFF, San Sebastian, New York Film Festival, I believe, in that order. I think that doesn't necessarily tell us what this showcase will mean for Emmanuel at San Sebastian. That being said, San Sebastian happens after TIFF and Telluride and Venice. So that this would mean, if it's the world premiere for Emmanuel, for Audrey Dewan, Noémie Merlant, Naomi Watts, that cannot necessarily help at least my, you know, prospective profile for Emmanuel, because I'm looking at it as like a bona fide best picture contender, best director contender, best screenplay contender, and this now seems like it's probably got to do the outside lane international feature path, and Audrey Dewan might still be a film away, even though I think, you know, her prowess as a director.
Or maybe it's the trailblazer to you know, legitimize the San Sebastian as an Oscars player. Maybe it rides the coattails of what, what Boy and the Heron did last year. Who knows?
And I'm not familiar with the festival as others may be. Maybe they have their Everything Everywhere All at Once, a la South by Southwest, in their past. I just don't know. I couldn't look it up. So
they, I believe they have a beach as well, San Sebastian.
But shout out to Wojciech Weischer, who asked us about what we think this means on Twitter there. And yeah, I had high expectations for Emmanuel. And this does, you know, the world premiere fact about Emmanuel going to San Sebastian. That's what threw me a little bit, because
as opposed to a higher profile festival.
Well, if it was not the world premiere, then it could go to TIFF first. Then it could go to somewhere else first. Right.
tempering your expectations. But to be fair, where we are now is closer to the Oscars than where we were a couple days ago. And as we get closer to the Oscars, those 100% accurate predictions become less. We've said that numerous times.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah, there's,
so
there's
once we
out.
Put them out there, yeah, we get less accurate.
We're just a conduit. Yeah. We're just a conduit for the information. Let's talk about some trailers. Mike, the second trailer for Twister's drop, you saw it before virtually anyone on this earth because they played it in front of The Fall Guy, which you went to see, and then it just came online on YouTube about an hour before we hit record here.
Thought I was going to be cool, give you guys some information that nobody saw except for the people that saw The Fall Guy, but yeah, everybody saw it now. So Glenn Powell didn't seem like he was acting in a G.I. Joe movie in this trailer. Did you feel that way?
I don't know. I got caught up in his eyes.
You get some backstory on Daisy Edgar Jones, like, I'm never chasing tornadoes again. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, I don't that's exactly what happens. I don't need the characters in Twister, by the way. Like, I don't need to know anything. Like, we get it. They're chasing Twisters.
So Brandon Perea, he is doing the Philip Seymour Hoffman Dustin impersonation.
Yes.
And listen, I got to be honest with you. Between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Boogie Nights and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Twister, I did not like Philip Seymour Hoffman's earlier work.
Well, he wasn't.
Some people did.
I agree those are roles that you go back on reflexively after he's legitimized himself, and then you go, oh, look at the decisions he's making. You know, those aren't the roles that stick with you as you see them in real time in 1997, yeah.
He was kind of the creepy stalker in Boogie Nights, right? I mean, he was in that role, and then,
he was lovelorn, Mike. How dare you? That man had a
broken
heart.
Lovelorn, he's a bit of a creep.
Oh, he's a creep, but when Harry met Sally, that guy's just a romantic. It's bullshit. That's why I hate that movie.
I appreciate you for sticking up for PSH. I'm not going to argue with you. I haven't seen Boogie Nights in 20 years.
I
will say...
It holds up. It's good.
Does it? Okay,
yeah,
good.
It's good.
I think Brandon Perea, he's going off here. He's going to 11 here.
Yeah.
And it makes sense.
Looks that way. I agree.
But I'm just still not into this property as much because I'm letting a little cynicism in. Like, it feels like it's requeling or requaking like so hard, Michael, Twisters. No?
I mean, I definitely get that, but my argument there, if I'm defending it, would be, what do you want us to do? It's a movie about tornadoes.
I want a new story. They're remaking Twister.
What story would you like about a Twister? There's two of them this time.
There were two of them last time.
Were there two of them last
time?
Twins
last time. Philip Seymour Hoffman yelled the same thing. Twins.
All right. I didn't remember that. So I'm like,
twins.
I don't know. Hey, remember that marketing for that beer? And twins.
That's might be what I'm confusing.
Yeah, we're old.
Terrible. We are old.
All right. But like, look. Does it look the same as the original? Yes. But I don't know what.
You want the original again.
It's not that I want it. I just don't know where you go with it. Mm-hmm. Like, these Twisters, and first of all, like, these Twisters come out of nowhere to all these people who are, like, at a baseball game or whatever, or a carnival. Does nobody watch the local news? Why are all these people still around if these harrowing, once-in-a-generation tornado alleys, like the news guy we see on the preview, says are coming? Like, people wouldn't be around.
Maybe... everybody cut the cord. Maybe everybody
they're all streamers
is not connected to their local patch. Maybe all the old people will be safe. Maybe
they
all the 40
weeks
plus
ago.
People will be safe. Yeah. They're in their cellar. They left. Mm-hmm. They're gone. They've battened down the hatches.
Yeah.
And all the young people are just like, yeah,
the Gen Zers.
Have service. I don't have service.
The millennials and the Gen Zers are screwed.
Yeah. But of service, why is it windy?
I don't know. It looks exactly like they're just remaking the original.
Why am I making fun of the people I want to be? I want to be cool again. No chance.
Again.
No chance. Just making fun of them. Well, because I work with high school kids, so I'm making fun of them. That's what I'm doing.
Well, in terms of ridiculous movies that we got our looks at, we saw our first look at Megalopolis as well. And,
yeah.
I mean, all I got from that trailer is that Adam Driver is playing Zach Morris. They got this exact same superpower.
So speaking of being old,
yeah.
Like I am old enough to have laughed very hard at this when I read what you wrote here in the copy. And so I had to do some improv over it. Can you imagine Francis Ford Coppola day drinking, watching Saved by the Bell, thinking about utopian societies and how Bayside High convinces him that there's really no such thing. And then Zach Morris breaks the fourth wall again, and he goes, "Eureka! Bravissimo! This is my next picture."
Not only can I imagine it, I would put money on that's exactly what happened.
I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
He's just wine drunk at 9:30 in the morning watching TBS. It's exactly Zach Morris's. Like, Adam Driver's on the edge of a building, he falls off, and then he says, "Time out," basically, and the world stops.
Yeah. This is the shtick. Right. Or it's the Matrix. I don't know what's going on.
It's not something I expected, I'll tell you that. Like, I didn't expect Megalopolis to go into surrealism. I thought it was a pretty straightforward post-apocalyptic movie.
Cinematography was gorgeous. Visual effects are simple, but it's striking.
Yeah.
It's a striking visual, and you know, absolutely sincerely touching when he dedicates the clip to his wife. So yeah, I mean, Megalopolis is turning into the humongous engine that should, or from the humongous engine that should to the little engine that could, right. Isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. We'll see what happens. It still needs a distributor and still needs to find an audience, I think, based on everything we're hearing.
I'm starting to root for the guy that had $120 million in disposable income. Starting to root for him just a little bit.
As far as billionaires go, he might be my favorite. Lee is a September 20th release from Roadhouse and Vertical. It had its premiere at TIFF in 2023. Story of photographer Elizabeth Lee Miller, a fashion model who became an acclaimed war correspondent for Vogue magazine during WW2. I thought about putting Kate Winslet in my five during our 100% accurate Oscar predictions last week. Yeah. This certainly looks like it could give her a chance to put forth an Oscars caliber performance. I like the Andy Samberg as the sidekick thing. I forgot that he plays a role in this. This is another movie I feel like we've just been previewing for forever.
It has. It premiered, like you said, at TIFF a year ago. It did not have distribution then, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
It wound up with Roadside and Vertical, September release. A lot of red flags in terms of Oscars.
Yeah.
Prognosticating. In terms of the trailer, it looks like we're getting some big emotional performances. Marion Cotillard is losing her mind with ugly cry scene there. I mean, obviously, this is World War II, so it makes sense.
Right.
There's Kate Winslet doing quite the accent, trying to be Lee Miller. But it's better than the last one she did, I would say. Well, the second to last one. The fifth to last one she did.
The Philly accent?
She was sucking down the Cheese Whiz, which is funny. Great. That was a good show. I enjoyed that show. I forget what it was called. The TV has no place in my brain. It's like the Snuffleupagus from Inside Out. But this is a great cast, man. Great cast for Lee. I'm rooting for it. It looks like it's a little strained in terms of the composition.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Red flags, like you said. Definitely. In a Violent Nature, we got a second look at that. It's a Sundance premiere. Comes out May 31st from IFC and Shudder. I am eternally fascinated by this movie because the longest joke in horror history has always been all you have to do to avoid any of these supernatural slashers is walk at a brisk pace and keep them behind you, right?
Yeah.
Because all these guys just walk slowly. And if we're sticking with the killer's POV, like we seem to be in this movie, that's going to make for an awfully boring movie, I think.
What if there's just like Chris Paul from the State Farm commercial just like race walking in front of him, doing laps around him? For 90 minutes, there's just a guy race walking with the headband and everything.
That's what I fear this is going to be.
Never going to catch me. greased up deaf guy from Family Guy. Oh, what a jerk I am. What a jerk. What a terrible quote. Look, I think the last shot gives us a little help for what's this movie, In a Violent Nature, in that we have a shot over the POV of a woman wearing a white dress shirt, and maybe she's the final girl. It was shown at the end of the trailer while we watch him whack and hack away at somebody, just overkill city.
It's definitely a shift in the perspective what we usually get from horror for that scene. Like, we see the bad guy come upon the girl. So he's not like a jump scare. We see him getting to her, and then she screams. So it's definitely like, I'm in for that. It's intriguing. I just don't like, do I want to see the downtime of what the killer does in between kills?
Yeah, not really. This is the thing. I think I watched one of those movies, or maybe even like 30 minutes of one of those, you know, killer POV movies. Like I've never seen The House That Jack Built. I've never seen Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. I've never seen any of the Maniacs, and whatever those films are, I don't watch them because I don't want to watch.
You don't want to stay with the serial. You don't want to stay with the killer.
This being said, this seems like a supernatural.
Yeah, this is like Jason.
Jason, iconic horror monster thing where they're going to play with the genre. And I think about, all right, there's some innovation here. This is an indie film. It's just like follow the killer. I just don't, like you said, I don't want it to get boring. But they're using the location like he's going over this. Crystal Lake looks beautiful in the spring. So I think I like when indie films use gorgeous locations. I'm wondering if there is Airbnbs around nearby.
Why do people keep coming here?
I just wonder. It looks beautiful. I mean, if he's done with his killing, I may just go up there after he's done.
He murders some teenagers, and then that's what he spends his downtime doing, is like prepping the bed and breakfast.
Then again, like, if this movie does not have any comedy, which it doesn't seem like it's going to have, if it does not have any of the wink-wink slasher, not, you know, because slasher movies are really, and it's important to have the POV of the final girls or the final
people,
because they're really morality tales, they're parables,
right?
And they're sick and twisted sometimes. But they're not just snuff films.
Right.
And if this is just a snuff film setup, obviously it's not a snuff film, but if it's just a murder spree setup, like, what are we doing? Yeah. Like, why? Why? Well, who's that for?
I like that you're worried about the ethics of it, and I'm just worried about being bored.
Is it just going
to... I mean, kill all the girls you want. Just don't bore me.
I mean, can he grab another weapon? Is it just a machete, or like this little
variety, spice of life stuff, you know? Go, I'm an idiot. Ghostlight, June 14th, Dolly De Leon, directed by Kelly O'Sullivan, who did St. Francis. When a construction worker unexpectedly joins a local theater's production of Romeo and Juliet, the drama on stage starts to mirror his own life. I don't think that does enough to justify the tone of this trailer. Which is something that hit way too close to home for someone raised in a household where at all times there was either zero emotion or every emotion, and discussing them in calm, mature settings was never an option. But, quote, many of us live our lives repressing our emotions because out there they can be a liability. In here, on stage, they can be put to good use. That's pretty much how I became a member of my local theater group after hearing this from this trailer.
Yeah, maybe the power of theater could connect with you, my friend. So this feels like the appetizer to Sing Sing on the year. That's not the fault of Ghostlight here. That's just the way it's kind of positioned in June 14th before early July, when Sing Sing comes out with a similar premise, even though a different setting. I liked St. Francis. I thought it was a solid indie film, even though it was a little slow, had a few lows from Kelly O'Sullivan there, but I enjoyed it, and I think there are much worse messages out there.
Sure.
Say the power of theater can help people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm down for the idea that this is being pitched. And it's not even really about theater. It's just about, you know, having the support for your emotional output.
I liked the whole father-daughter setup here. I liked it. I thought it made sense. I thought it fit.
Funny, too. She thinks he's cheating on mom because he walks in on a kissing scene on stage. And she's like, he's like, no, this is a play production. Yeah. It's good. Right. Cute.
It was cute. All right, Mike, did you watch the new trailer for Despicable Me 4?
I don't know why we're having the Oscars. Like, what about this didn't put a smile on your face?
The pre-trailer, too. It just leads
it's all
through an office
great.
Building to just watch great. Me, a cartoon me, eat some Jersey Mike's. Great. It was great. I agree. The punchlines, too. Or you just might explode. Really funny.
We get, after all these years, we get super minions now.
Well, here's the question. Like, is Minions going to make superheroes cool again? Like, are we going to have a July that says, all right, Minions made superheroes cool for the kids, and Deadpool and Wolverine made superheroes kind of cool again for the rest of us?
Interesting.
What do you think?
Interesting.
What do you think?
I like that as a narrative. Sure. Why not? I mean, they're definitely borrowing from established superheroes. One of the Minions is just Cyclops with the beam coming out of his eyes that go all the way through the South Pole. I laughed at that. That's a stupid joke, and it got me.
Stupid. It's funny. It's funny. And then the whole, every joke they've shown, like every elongated setup and payoff they've shown, has hit with me. It's like, maybe I am a friggin' doofy kid now. That's my
You can't tell me the world wouldn't be better if these guys were real.
Why can't you be like your sister? She lies to me all the time. No, I don't. See, she's lying to me right now. That's funny. It's funny. The whole popcorn thing and they show before every movie at AMC is funny.
Even the setup where they're announcing like the title card for the studio of Illumination, where they have the railgun of Christmas lights. And the minion comes in and turns on the light switch, and Illumination is illuminated with all the lights. And so the minion with the light gun turns to the other minion and then just starts shooting at him and running away towards him. Sign me up. Sign me up for all of this.
Damn it. Damn it. We're a Despicable Me podcast now. We're Minions.
Let's talk about some first looks we had, first reactions quickly this week. We had our first look at David Korn's sweat as Superman. He got taken to task for this poster, and it's hilarious. I mean, it's a good poster, putting on his shoes and stuff, putting on the Superman costume as mayhem goes on outside.
Even Superman puts his shiny red boots on one at a time, huh? So, like, this is all of film Twitter saying, stop trying to be relatable there, buddy. Right?
Oh, yeah. Superman. Yeah. And also, why are you so late? The mayhem's already happening. Thousands of people are being killed. What are you doing, Superman? Get out there.
You can put on the boots a little faster.
Right.
You get super
You're
speed.
Superman, for Christ's sake. Yeah.
So, well.
Maybe a different tone, though, is Furiosa, which we've had our reservations and concerns about. We have at least one insider who we trust speaking glowingly about it, Michael.
David Ehrlich of IndieWire says, it brings me great joy to report that Furiosa is really effing good. It operates on an extremely different gear than Fury Road in ways that I suspect will frustrate some people, but also manages to make that movie even richer while carving its own legend in the wasteland. David Ehrlich, now he's not one of those guys that likes everything. He is very up and down, vacillating.
Yes.
You know, and I appreciate him for that.
Absolutely.
So he likes this one, and I don't think it's because his old buddy at IndieWire wrote a book on, Fury Road. I think he likes this one.
I mean, it's when's the last time you heard him describe something as really, really effing good, with the second really having asterisks to separate? I mean, he's very high on this, it seems.
He's very high, and it's exciting. It's exciting because we're not very high on the marketing of Furiosa.
Right.
I think we've been very low on the marketing of Furiosa. So
done.
We need
itself no favors, I think, with the marketing. But yeah, so all right, maybe enough to kind of change our expectations for that. We'll get into a box office update, and we'll review some films along the way. The Fall Guy did win the weekend. 27.7 domestic opening weekend, did an additional about $37 million overseas. After Monday, its worldwide box office tally is $66.4 million, but that budget is about $140 million, $150 million, depending on where you look. So probably underperformed for its opening. And you saw it.
Yeah, that's not good. Not good. I did see it, and I will agree with our friends at Recent Activity. Andrew Morgan put out a good review of that this morning. So I'm on the same wavelength there, in a way, because I agreed with both of them. And I can enjoy, like, a tribute to stunt people, and this is a worthy tribute. I can enjoy and I can watch Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt flirt and banter for 90 minutes straight. So I'm wondering why they kind of went away from Gosling and Blunt for long stretches of this movie. But yeah, I mean, we got Journey's music over the trailer, Mike, and the greatest pop songs of the last 50 years are in this soundtrack. It was really good. I even liked the Taylor Swift song a lot, like a lot more than I ever knew I liked any Taylor Swift songs. And I liked that joke, and I liked that play out. So there's like a 30-minute sweet spot for The Fall Guy where you're watching a really good movie with back-to-back-to-back fun scenes kind of at the between like the 15-minute mark and the 45-minute mark, somewhere in there. And then you're just wondering, like, why isn't this just 2 hours of Gosling and Emily Blunt at a karaoke bar? Do we need anything else? Like, there are three increasingly corny, mind-numbing action scenes with some of the cheesier payoffs you've seen in a while. And I don't want any of that. And it's unfortunate because one of those sequences finishes the film.
No.
And there's just, like, other cardinal sins that this movie commits. Like, one of the first fight sequences is just immediately proven unnecessary right after they complete it. So you're like, fooled ya! Come on. And we're asked to believe she's directing the next great blockbuster movie, which looks exactly like some exact send-up of John Carter versus Cowboys and Aliens. It's like one of those
two. Oh, no.
So the fake movie couldn't look worse. And then they also have this fourth action sequence that actually is not bad. Like, there's a satisfying dramatic irony to it, and I allow the cheesiness of this action sequence to play out. But instead of building into it playfully, they give you, like, the craziest threat at the beginning where Ryan Gosling is just, like, threatened with this fate worse than death, this death that's so horrifying that you think of Ken, this happening to Ken, this beloved character who's on a charm offensive throughout.
Right.
And you're like, nothing can be funny. Nothing can possibly be funny after we've threatened Ryan Gosling with this heinous death. So I'm traumatized by that setup. So, like, everything just felt excessive and superfluous on the plot front for The Fall Guy, and it just ruined it. Like, the plot and everything that bloated the budget on The Fall Guy seemed to have ruined The Fall Guy.
But to do this movie properly, you kind of have to have a big budget. Don't, like, if you're going to do a blockbuster stuntman and really, like, make him seem like he's actually doing crazy stunts and part of an actual blockbuster movie world, you have to have a big budget attached to it, no?
I enjoyed when they're showing Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt doing the stuntman work. That was so much fun. Like, just to watch her as a director, him as the stuntman,
right,
faking all the stunts or doing all the real stunts, but whatever. I mean, that was fun. That was the most fun part of the movie. But when he's like this stuntman who's also quote unquote Jason Bourne, doing some Jason Bourne stuff, you know, that's stupid. The mystery's stupid. The plot is stupid. Whoever wrote this movie, not good.
I also take issue with, I haven't seen this movie, but just the idea of, like, people all the time are saying, man, Hollywood just keeps making the same stuff. We want new original ideas. We want original IP. Well, no, you don't. I mean, because
this is not original IP, though.
Is this an adaptation?
It's based on a TV series.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
It's based on a 6-season TV series. And
fine, but it's from years ago, too, isn't it?
Right. It's more original than,
right,
you know.
I mean, like I don't,
other stuff.
And it couldn't have had a better marketing push.
The marketing push was great.
It couldn't have had.
The problem is the movie is execution dependent, isn't it? And then
so what? I guess it goes back to my point. Like, doesn't, so what matters is the goods, doesn't it?
Well, here's the issue. So I don't know why I'm saying this, because it's not necessarily execution dependent. People knew going in that this was tremendously well reviewed.
Right.
I think, and we could talk to Tom about this in the next episode, I think this movie was marketed to us, 30 and 40 somethings, and we wanted to see it, and we saw it, and or I saw it now, you'll see it later. Mm-hmm. You were probably going to.
Yeah.
But now maybe not.
Exactly. I mean, I was planning on seeing it, certainly.
But you're not going to see it for the stunts in theaters,
right?
Are you?
No, no.
You don't care to see these stunts on the big screen.
No.
So if you don't care, then you'll wait a month and you'll watch it mm-hmm. at home to watch the charm offensive of Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt.
Right. I am wondering. I mean, well, and it goes to, it just, look, second at the box office this week was Star Wars Episode One, a re-release, okay? And that's kind of where I'm going with this, is like, I do think theaters are still in trouble, and not just because The Fall Guy underperformed. Like, there's just not a lot out there still. And the stuff that is coming out, Challengers was third, Terror was fourth, its debut, had its a worldwide debut of $10 million. People still just aren't getting out there in the numbers they were in previous years for these weekends.
It's not great. It's not great. April was not as good as we hoped, even though there's some bright spots. Yeah, I'm not sure. And again, I look at what the investment is by the studios. And again, we're going to ask Tom about mm-hmm. something like Challengers that does 7.6. That's up to about $30 million on a $55 million budget. What does Challengers really need to make for Amazon? Right? What does it need to make in theaters? Is it a bonus for Challengers to play 6 weeks in theaters and build up the cachet, but most of the target audience
is
waiting for it right. to come and watch it on stream?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate question. And if that's the case,
therefore,
then we're not going to get
any. Fine with that.
Yeah, we're not going to get any adult dramas in theaters. Never mind that they're a dwindling genre right now.
Well, they don't mind put them in theaters, but there's no imperative to just like leave it in theaters for 6 months and draw out the window so people have an understanding that there's an exclusivity there, at least for the first quote unquote window of whatever it is, what it used to be, right? The long ass window. Mm-hmm. So where if you want to see this movie, you better go see it in theaters. Because right now they could just wait for it on streaming, and they don't have to wait for it that long, especially with PVOD in the mix. Mm-hmm. Like Challengers, I mean, I think you know you could watch it in a week or two.
Yeah, right.
So why do you need to see Challengers in the movie theater other than to say you saw it a couple weeks early?
That's a huge question. I agree. Especially when we have the evidence that people would rather wait and see it. And, you know, we have these polls coming out. It's not like 51% of people are saying, like, if 2/3 of adults that are responding to these polls are saying they're going to wait to see it at home, I'm just as guilty as any of one of those 2/3 of people. I think there's a problem with theaters right now. Like, they get
that's a problem. And it's not a problem for studios. It's a problem for theaters.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Which, again, goes back to why maybe Sherry Redstone wants to divest herself of National Amusements and why that's so important to her to agree to any Paramount deal. It's just to get these, you know, it's a whole, everything's intertwined with everything in this industry.
Proportionally, it's a problem for studios, yes, because they're still doing good business in theaters to a degree. But it's not.
Yeah, but they can get money. I mean, there's much more money available to studios, maybe not to actors, which is a whole different conversation, but there's much more money available to studios in second run nowadays than there were previously. Like you said, with PVOD and streaming and all that. Consider going on here, Tarot, like we said, $6.5 million, $10 million worldwide for its gross thus far. Godzilla and Kong. Go ahead.
Mike, Tarot is being talked about like it flopped. 6.5, fourth place. It's an $8 million production budget. It's going to be profitable. It's going to be in the black next week.
Do you want to be
shocked?
What
are people talking about?
Do you know what the biggest horror debut weekend was? What movie had the biggest horror debut in 2024 thus far?
I don't know.
Night Swim.
Yeah.
That's crazy, isn't it?
These movies have been leggy. They've done okay because they've been niche properties. They've been smartly budgeted. You know, the first Omen and Abigail are probably looked on recently as not failures, but not working to the extent that they needed to work, even right. though I think critically they were well-liked and First Omen really well-liked.
And these are, again, properties that I think are going to play better once they hit PVOD. Like, I'm going to watch Tarot when it comes to – it'll be on in the background one day.
Tarot, because you know it's a bad horror movie.
Right.
It's a 21%er, right?
Right.
But if it was a good horror movie –
oh, sure. You would have
the impetus
to. You
still want to go see
a
good horror movie
absolutely,
in theaters.
Absolutely.
Because that's a unique.
But then it goes back to my question. Like, okay, so the goods are still what matters, right? Not promotion, not any kind of marketing campaign. Like, if you, the movie and word of mouth seems to rule all when it comes to box office.
Yeah, it's an interesting confluence of factors. Yeah. I'm not necessarily sure about what you said, though, because.
All right. Fair enough. Godzilla
and
Kong.
It's complicated.
It certainly is. Godzilla and Kong is fifth. It's up to $546 million for its worldwide box office gross, still hanging in the top five. Civil War down to sixth thus far, but it is over the $100 million mark, $104.5 million for its worldwide box office.
So Godzilla just passed $500 million, but it did another 46 in the last 10 days. It must have did buku bucks overseas. It must still be playing very strong overseas. And Civil War has played much stronger overseas than I feared. So Civil War is already over $100 million. That's probably getting close to profitability before it ends its theatrical run. And then you'd think it's going to get over the hump immediately for A24 with PVOD. And then we're looking at Civil War, obviously making money for A24 and all the windowing afterwards, especially with the Max, destination
right.
at the end of it all.
Right.
That's value in terms of the sale of A24 films to Max.
Still excited to see that. Unsung Hero finished seventh. Kung Fu Panda 4 up to 520 worldwide. Abigail down in ninth. It's about $35 million for its worldwide box office gross. Ghostbusters rounds out the top 10 with the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare in 11th. And Dune Part 2 up to $708 million worldwide, but it's under $1 million for its weekend gross domestically.
All right, what is my guess in terms of a confidence scale on how much you will like these three films, Challengers, Civil War, or Dune Part 2? If you have to guess, I am wondering how you will like these films. You have to guess what I think.
I'm guessing
you will think
how you think I will rank. I will rank these three. How,
yes,
like, how do you want me to rank
those
like,
three?
Just one, two, three?
What do you... What would be your guess of my guess?
Of how I would rank these. One, two, three.
Did everybody just shut us off immediately? Because they can't. They're like, short circuit. They think we short circuit.
Just hearing a high-pitched hum and a nosebleed.
Challengers, Civil War, Dune Part 2. What are you going to think of those? What do you think you'll think of those?
How am I ranking these? Just like on a scale of 1 to 10, 1, 2, 3.
So let's ask the question first. No, just do you think you'll like Dune, Civil War, or Challengers most?
There is zero chance I like Dune most.
Right. So Civil War you're expecting to like most? I expect you to like Civil War least.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
I expect you to like Dune the most.
Now.
And Challengers the second
is
most.
Is this how you really feel? Or are you trying to like Inception reverse psychology me? So I like Dune the most.
That's a great question. I'm not going to tell you the answer.
Okay.
Because if I told you the answer, you're going to hate that movie.
That's correct. Yes. We've gotten to the point we can't have a real conversation on this show anymore. We got to speak in like tongues and levels in between the lines.
We've been doing this shit for too long.
Good. All right. Let's end with some reviews. We both watched some stuff. Mike, you started. You got through The Idea of You, which got surprisingly decent reviews all around.
Anne Hathaway, some guy's name who I can't pronounce, who's very good in the movie, by the way. The Idea of You was a good movie until the BS ending. So shout out to Olivia and Harry. I genuinely enjoyed all of the commiseration of the quote, we 40-year-olds are probably too old to be cool still, but I don't know. Let's just have some fun and let's do it anyway and see what happens. Storyline. I like that.
Good.
I had fun with that until I didn't. At the very end. But most of the way, I had fun with the idea of you.
Good.
I did.
Good. All right. I'm glad to hear that. So you enjoyed it. I didn't almost watch that, but I did almost watch Turtles All the Way Down. I didn't. You did. I watched something else that I think might be in the same vein, but go ahead.
A girl with OCD and her best friend are on the hunt for their classmate's missing father to earn the reward money to help them because they're hard up on going to college. So, like, look, this is like a solid story. I mean, this is based on a very famous novel, best-selling novel. So, like, coming-of-age stories that involve, like, these tropey characters and quests like this don't typically work on a dramatic level. They're not even attempted on a dramatic level. Usually, like, you see coming-of-age movies like this with quests turned into comedies, sex road trip comedies,
right,
or whatever. Turtles All the Way Down just has a really good ensemble that's convincing to me, even when the title is put into a monologue by J. Smith Cameron of Succession, which I thought she pulled out. I mean, it was Anthony Hopkins level expo dump abilities there by J. Smith Cameron. Another terrific mother character from Judy Reyes. This year she did Birth Rebirth as well. I thought she was awesome in that. She's been on Scrubs, obviously, and she's kind of reinventing herself in a dramatic way as a dramatic actress. So this is one of those, like, surprise. Like, I still don't love Turtles All the Way Down. B-minus grade for me, but it's like a surprising B-minus. So it's a good job by actor-director Hannah Marks, who I just watched this movie because of her, because I really liked the last movie she did. Mark Mary and some other people that I saw, I believe, at a Tribeca. So I was a fan of hers, and yeah, Turtles All the Way Down wasn't bad. It was solid.
Good.
Solid movie.
In lieu of watching Turtles All the Way Down, I watched Prom Dates on Hulu.
I was going to watch that next, and I was going back and forth with those. What did you think of Prom Dates?
I don't want to speak negatively, but, like, teen comedies can be good, right?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like even the lewd ones and the super low-hanging fruit ones, like Bachelor Party and Revenge of the Nerds, I feel like those still hold up somewhat in different ways. I don't understand how it's possible that those seem less outdated than something just made in 2024. And nothing landed with me. It seemed like it was trying too hard. It seemed like it was trying to, like, be this, like, a throwback to, like, this culty, memorable coming-of-age comedy, but nothing stuck with me. I didn't really appreciate the characters. I didn't like the central conflict. It was just all around a poor watching experience for me. I didn't even finish them. There was 20 minutes left, and I was like, I'm just done. I can't do it anymore. So I tapped out.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was not great. I gave it a D. Not happy with me.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I'm sad. I was hoping for something. I wanted to be uplifted. I was hoping for, like, this fun, you know, coming-of-age story between these two characters that had this, like, prom deal back when they were kids. And it's just like, oh, it's just trying to be, like, a forced comedy thing.
All right. That sucks. Yeah. Did you watch anything else before our final review here? Or we get into it?
Nothing happy. The other movie I watched wasn't happy. I did not like the Sidney Sweeney horror movie.
Oh, Immaculate. You didn't like Sidney Sweeney.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't crazy about it. I just wasn't.
None movie.
No, I wasn't.
So, no, but you didn't like the ending? You didn't even like the ending?
Nothing.
The ending was, like, rad, no?
It was fine. I don't want to speak too negatively.
What else do you want from a movie like Immaculate?
I don't know.
Like,
maybe that's it. Maybe my hype was too high for it.
In all fairness, I gave it, like, a low B. It wasn't like I gave it a rousing review.
Yeah, I'm like a C- on it, yeah.
Definitely lulled going in there, but then it was like...
Mm. Yeah, it's like, oh, she's that one's possessed, and maybe this one, yeah, I've seen it. I don't know. I wasn't crazy about it. What I have been watching, before we get to the final thing, you know nothing about the hip-hop world, right?
Not really, Mike.
Okay.
No, I mean, not since I was, you know... In high school and college, obviously.
Right. So you don't, you have.
And still, a little bit, but not like the new.
You haven't been following the Drake and Kendrick Lamar.
Not the youngsters. No, yeah. I mean, the most I know is through the kids I work with.
So I, for whatever reason, as a very, very white guy growing up in very, very suburbia, have always had this affinity for diss tracks and hip hop beefs. so this past weekend, like, I've been reveling in it, and I've been following it and eating up as much of it as I can. I'm Team Kendrick all the way, by the way. I think he absolutely murdered Drake. But nonetheless, what it did was it reignited me to go back and watch. So on DVD back in the day, not Blu-ray, DVD back in the day, there was a trilogy of Beef documentaries. There was called Beef, Beef 2, and Beef 3. And all they were documentaries about past hip-hop beefs. And I used to own them on DVD. I'm probably the whitest person to ever own these DVDs back in the day. And I wore them out back in the day. And watching all this Drake Kendrick stuff happen, I was like, you know what? I got to watch Beef again. So it's on YouTube, thankfully. I knew it would be. All of them are on YouTube. So I worked my way through the first two Beefs again, Beef and Beef 2. And they're great. They just, you know, they get all the people involved in all the beefs, the old hip-hop beefs, talking about what happened in real time. It goes back to, like, the late 70s when hip-hop started, and the bridge is over, and the two Roxannes battling with each other. It's all these old and relatively new. I mean, I think they came out in, like, 2003, 2004, so it's not that recent, but all these relatively recent hip-hop beefs, and you get them straight from the horse's mouth, and you hear all the stories about it, and they're great, and they're fun, and they're trashy, and it's everything I wanted it to be, and remembered it as being.
Is this narrated by Ving Rhames?
The first one might be. The second one is definitely by Keith David, no question.
Okay.
Definitely narrated by Keith David. The first one maybe is Ving Rhames? I can't really remember.
Narrated by Ving Rhames, because I'm searching it on IMDb as you say it. I'm going to have to watch these at some point, because I remember all that. On YouTube, huh?
Yeah. Beef. They're like, Beef, you know, they're like an hour and a half and each, three. And they're just, they're great. Oh, nice. I wore those DVDs out back in the day. Meet the Gramps was brutal, an absolutely brutal district. Not Like Us was brutal. Kendrick has just been on fire. Anyway.
Wow.
Okay, let's end on the dual review here.
Yeah, so we both agree that it has been a horrible press tour for Jerry Seinfeld.
Yes.
In front of Unfrosted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, film Twitter hates him right now.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time in a while, we don't necessarily blame them for doing
right.
So. We don't blame film Twitter for their opinion. For once. How is this happening? Anyway, like, Seinfeld has just been belligerent about, like, cancel culture is the death of comedy.
He's turned into the old man yelling at the cloud.
He's insufferable.
Yeah.
Now, there was kind of a funny save where he's on SNL's Weekend Update as the guy who's done too much press,
mm-hmm.
which was kind of funny.
It was kind Almost of funny. Funny. Yeah, I agree. Kind of funny is a good way of putting it.
So we both went into watching Unfrosted, like,
which was getting killed.
Getting killed, which I watch Unfrosted. I laugh like a hyena
so
the whole
many
movie.
Times. I hate how much I like this movie.
We're so white. The throwaway lines are worth their weight in gold. Like, there's so many funny scenes, funny characters, funny cameos. I'm underselling it. I wrote down I probably laughed 20 times. I think I laughed 50 times. And a couple of those times, it's good, the good stuff, the belly.
I laughed.
Damn it.
Yeah, I laughed hard at least three or four, like hard at least three or four times. And I went into this, I was all anti-Seinfeld because I don't like the person he's become comedically. The idea, whenever comics blame cancel culture, I get, like, my red flag goes up. And I have issues with Seinfeld as the person, certainly not as the show and the writer. I've separated the art from the artist in my mind, apparently. But God damn, did I like this movie, and did it hit my funny bones in the way that I was ashamed at myself while laughing. I couldn't help it.
Well, we were quoting it like idiots before
it's
the show.
It's so decided. Stupid funny and so
stupid
good.
Stupid funny.
Jim Gaffigan is so good. Bobby Moynihan, I said to you, he should just live his life as Chef Boyardee from now on. As should James Marsden just be Jack LaLanne.
I was dying. Just James Marsden kind of looking around the room, John Travolta in Pulp Fiction style, after he's whispering to him about the fact that he doesn't wear underwear. It's not okay. It needs to change. He needs to wear underwear the next time they have a marketing session together, and he's running, he's moving around the office.
the flubber stuff, like the sea monkey flubber life form stuff. It's just so the kids who are way too into
the kids in the dumpster
just are so like they're just espousing these wit and wisdoms.
Yeah, no, we're exiled with Jerry Seinfeld just for liking his movie.
I cannot believe, especially after reading all the denigration, I was like, I was ready to hate watch it. That's why I turned it on. That's the only reason I turned it on. I was like, all right, let's see how bad this is. I fucking loved
down,
it.
I wrote down before before I changed it, I wrote down like, you know, Mike, this is your fault. You made me watch all of Seinfeld. I've watched all of Curb. I have to watch this stupid movie now, Unfrosted. We like the trailer, so what are we going to, you know, are we hypocrites?
It was so good.
But it's a good movie.
It's so good. I can't believe how good it was. And we're the only people that feel this way, by the way. I have not seen one even, like, remotely positive review from anyone on film Twitter, certainly.
No. This is Walk Hard all over again, isn't it? This is MacGruber all over again. We're the only... But we do have a proclivity to love spoofy... stupid.
Well, I tried, Mike.
Comedy.
I tried, like, even I was 20 minutes in. I was like, okay, this is trying to do the weird movie, trying to be Weird Al Yankovic, and it won't be that funny. And I get, God damn it. It was good.
Funny as hell.
It was so funny.
There's even an awards show fake. And afterwards, they're like, and we own the Golden Spoons. But don't tell anybody. We've covered it up for
you. You know how hard I've tried to keep people from knowing that?
I was dying. The throwaway lines, it kills me. It's
Bobby
Moynihan
is speaking Italian, and what he says has nothing to do with anything.
I'm gonna have to rewatch. We're talking ourselves into rewatching this movie.
I'm going
like
to rewatch
tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. I have.
Of course we are. Of course we are. I mean, it's what was that? I mean, Netflix. Obviously, I Think You Should Leave has been there. You know, comedy gold, right?
Yeah.
Has anything else hit the zeitgeist in terms of their comedy stuff? Tom Brady roast now.
Yeah. But, oh, yeah. I forgot. Did you watch that?
I did.
What did you think?
It was funny. I was laughing like a jerk the whole time, and it's evil and it's funny. And I think the beginning was funny. Like, Tom Brady was not funny.
Tom
Kim Brady's Kardashian,
such a stooge.
Not funny.
Yeah. Okay. I kind of felt bad for Kim Kardashian. Like,
me too.
Taylor Swift has murdered her like Kendrick has murdered Drake.
But Kim wasn't funny. That was the problem.
No, she wasn't. You're right.
She wasn't
right.
Funny. And then, so, I mean, you either kill or be killed, I guess. I don't know.
Some of the stuff I felt got too mean.
Oh, definitely got too mean. And, it was a 3-hour roast.
Yeah, but it's like, do we really need to talk about Aaron Hernandez this much? The guy's got a family out there, you know what I mean?
It was horrible. It was horrible.
So, I mean, I don't know. I know I'm in the minority. Like, yeah, it was funny. Some of it was good, but I was just like, all right, this is kind of hitting the same beats over and over.
But, like, Drew Bledsoe is funny.
He was great.
And then Nikki Glaser kills. She was just so funny. But even Gronk, when he comes back out there, you know, he's funny for most of it, and then he's like, total a-hole for the end of it. Like, what are we doing?
Right.
So it's like, he's funny for most of it, and then the problem is, like, when you're there for 3 hours and you're living in it, like, the true colors are gonna fly.
That's
so
true.
Like, the homophobia is just as uncomfortable as you can get, so it's terrible. So, like, the night seemed to spiral into a kind of a bad time at the end, even though most of it was really good.
I do wonder who's going to be next, because it was a bona fide success for Netflix. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody watched it. It was like an old school HBO show, it felt like. Like, everybody was tuned in at the same time watching the same thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I thought Kevin Hart did a really good job.
He was good, And I wonder if that was his, like, Oscars host, like, audition tape, even though we know what happened with him when he was supposed to be tabbed to host the Oscars years ago.
I don't think the Oscars want mean comedy. They don't want the mean insult comedy.
No,
they don't want it.
They certainly don't.
I don't think they'd go for it. And I don't blame them. You kind of just want to, you know, the celebratory comedy. We're kind of...
And that's why John Mulaney's doing his LA show.
Maybe if the Oscars are getting... Right. Yeah. John Mulaney seems like that makes some sense.
Netflix dipping its toe more and more into live stuff, live action stuff.
Oh yeah, did you watch the John Mulaney show yet?
I've only seen highlights and clips. I haven't watched the whole thing.
I watched the David Letterman interview. That was good.
Oh, was it? I meant to watch that too, and I didn't get to it.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, we'll see what happens here. A lot of interesting times in streaming. A lot of interesting times in live events too.
Definitely. I was surprised at how big the Tom Brady roast was.
Same. They picked a great night for it. There wasn't a lot going on in the sports world.
How big that hit. Yeah, that was huge. Yeah.
All righty. Well, there you go. That is, go in expecting stupid comedy and go watch Unfrosted, I guess, is our our headline from this. But as always, what matters most to us, dear listener, are your thoughts. Did you watch any of these things that we have just reviewed and watched? Do you have any thoughts on the Paramount deal? Do you have any thoughts on the trailers that we covered or any of the film festival or awards news that we covered in this episode? As well, as always, you can leave us those on our social medias, along with any other thoughts, comments, questions, or concerns you have about anything we do here in the MMO Empire. We are Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook and Instagram, at MM and Oscar on Twitter, Mike, and Oscar at gmail.com, and on Reddit. We're available wherever you do hear podcasts, and if you listen to us on either the Apple Podcast or Spotify app. If you appreciate what we do, if you wouldn't mind leaving us a 5-star review, those help us out. Thank you to everyone who has done so thus far. Michael, tell the good people what's coming next, even though you've hinted at it a couple times already, and let's have some words of wisdom to end on.
Yeah, we have a interview booked, supposedly. I let the cat out of the bag and jinx it? Or
well, you've said
I
Tom already.
Say,
it's not Tom Brady.
Bergerman.
Right.
It's not Brady. This is IndieWire's box office, featured box office writer that we've been citing for years. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have Tom on and ask him a bunch of burning questions, and we're really looking forward to that. I think we'll have him on at some point, even if, you know, our houses fall down in a twins twister. Definitely misquoting
as they want to do
Bud Light commercial. Yeah, so we got that coming, and we got Mike and Alien coming. We got a bunch of movies. Now here's the question: when are you watching Dune 2? Like, we may have a gap in the schedule coming up. Like, do we do a Dune 2 film study? Like, I keep asking you this: when are you gonna watch it? Like, when is this what do I gotta do to get you to watch
I was
a movie
hovering
that's gonna
over
get nominated
it.
For 10 Oscars, Mike?
I was hovering over it the other night, and I was like, I cannot in good conscience pay $20 to see it. That's more than it would cost to go see it at the theater.
You bet on coin tosses. Hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
That's all that enough said. I know you didn't like the first one. I know you have your grudges.
I very much dislike
the
first one.
You say. Okay. Well, I mean, it's supposed to come on HBO Max. I keep calling it that on Max, you know, relatively soon.
That's actually the other part of it is that, like, all right, you get it for 48 hours. Well, what if I need like 3 nights to like get into it?
What if you need 3 nights to watch it?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
You're like the runner who hasn't run in months.
I've been watching.
This is what
I've been watching movies,
you.
But not 3
yeah,
hours.
Yeah, no, you okay. You're on the elliptical.
Not 3 hours. Yeah.
It's not necessarily 3 hours, though. I just didn't view it as like a tough sit. It wasn't like a difficult watch.
But you also have a penchant for sci-fi.
You may not like it.
Yeah.
I watch a movie every night, so
you do.
I don't have an issue.
I'm in awe of it.
I don't have this performance anxiety that you seem to have here. How else can I shame you into watching this movie? Like a terrible, terrible friend.
Well, guys, when reality sucks,
we do a podcast on Dude 2. Damn it, we do this. Podcast is essentially dedicated to Dune 2. You haven't watched it yet. I'm just
what do you mean
perturbed.
It's dedicated to Dune 2? We didn't talk about Dune 1.
This year, Dune 2
is the podcast
be like
overall.
The Oscars movie.
We're gonna,
yeah.
You know I'm going to watch it.
You're going to watch it. Just like when?
I don't know.
Next month? Next year?
2026, maybe?
I got to do the programming. That's kind of, I don't know, somebody stuck me with that job, I guess.
Yeah, you.
Well, what do you want to do?
I edit. What do I want to do?
We're having another crisis at the end of an episode. It's elongating the runtime.
Yeah, we gotta end this. All right, guys. When reality sucks, you could have a crisis with us. We are Mike, Mike, and Oscar trying to make award season year-round without the stuffiness. We will see you all very soon.
Yeah, now Tom's like, forget
yeah,
this
right.
shit. If he made it to this. These guys are buffoons.
He's out.
See ya.